Hello and welcome to another current affairs edition of Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco. Just as one housing minister gets his feet under the table, another one turns up to replace him, the third one so far this year. We consider the implications for government housing policy of the appointment of Kit Malthouse. Accommodation portal student.com has joined forces with mental health charity Student Minds to help student landlords prioritise mental health. We ask, what kind of training, support and advice do they need? Will the Bank of England raise interest rates at its next meeting in August, and what impact might that have on falling buy-to-let lending? But we start this programme with government proposals for three-year mandatory tenancies outlined in its consultation paper with the snappy title, Overcoming Barriers to Longer Tenancies in the Private Rented Sector. Joining me is Chris Norris, Director of Policy and Practice at the National Landlords Association, and I'm delighted to welcome Deputy Editor of Property and Personal Finance from the Times, Carol Lewis. Now, Carol, let me come to you first. 38% of households in the private rented sector have children or dependents. Shelter says that 43% of them are worried that they're going to lose their home, and that in fact 7 in 10 do want longer tenancies. How do you respond to this government consultation?
I think it's important to say, first of all, it's a consultation. They don't use the word mandatory in the document. They use the word minimum three-year tenancies. They've got a range of proposals there, of which this is probably the most extreme. So it's not a surprise, because they seem very intent on pushing build to rent. They want to see purpose-built blocks of accommodation funded by institutional finance, our pensions, insurance policies, and managed by corporations. And it's a model that works well elsewhere in the world. It's very young in this country, but already they appear to be offering three-year tenancies as a minimum, as standard. So it's not a surprise, given that they favour build-to-rent, that they want to pull the rest of the industry in line with that.
Chris, Section 21 and no-fault evictions seem to be becoming a bit of a dirty word, really. And I guess part of the implication of this change is, of these proposed changes, is that landlords have too much power and some are abusing it. Now, only 10% of tenancies are actually ended by the landlord, and the vast majority that are ended is because of arrears, or because the landlord wants to move in or sell the property. Only another 5% are ended because of a poor relationship by the landlord. The vast majority are ended by the tenant. So, you know, why do we need mandatory three-year tenancies, given that most landlords are behaving reasonably well with the current regime?
Well, you've raised some really good points there, and I think the question is, do we need them, not why do we need them? Carol was absolutely right. This is a consultation, not a proposal. And it's a consultation from a government that has very little means to actually legislate right now. So I think if you read this document in any detail, you can see they're not really sure where they're going. They're throwing out a whole raft of different ways they might be able to implement this. And there's actually a section discussing implementation. If you had a government that actually had a policy they wanted to implement, it would be telling us what they want to do, how they want to do it, and working, yes, with stakeholders to make sure that it reflects the intent that they had in mind. I don't think this does. I think what we're looking at is a reaction to new entrants in the market, the build-to-rent providers that we've talked about already, but also a recognition that the sector hasn't really kept up with the way that the demographics who live in the private rented sector, how they're formed. I think we've got a system that was created in the mid-1980s that's become culturally embedded. There are certain behaviours that landlords, you know, opt to persevere with or pursue, and we need a bit of nudging. But there's a great difference between a nudge to make sure that people negotiate and get the right tenancies for them, and some kind of mandation or some kind of minimum term. I mean, crucially, they talk about the model tenancy. The model tenancy is a bit of a joke. It's existed for the last 8 or 9 years. I was on the panel that created it. I don't think anybody's ever used it. So saying they'll use that to push longer tenancies, you know, it's them demonstrating that they are doing something without actually doing anything.
Well, the proposal is for a minimum 3-year tenancy with a 6-month break clause in. After the 6-month break clause, only the tenant can give notice of 2 months, and the landlord might be able to give notice if they want to sell. That's the proposal. How much of this is just political, do you think, Carol? Because, of course, the government has its eye on those younger voters, many of whom are living in the private rented sector.
Oh, it's definitely political. I don't think politicians do anything that's not political. I think actually it's not particularly aimed at the younger vote, because as we've discussed, there are more families, they're more older, there are people who are 65 plus in rental accommodation. So it's not a kind of millennial grabbing move. If they wanted to do that, they'd go straight in for student loans. But it comes at time when they appear to be actively trying to push buy-to-let landlords out. I think that's the important thing. The timing seems just so wrong-headed to me. So they appear to be all in favour of build-to-rent, yet that's very young. It's not built up to the levels it needs to be. But before they've got it where they need it to be, they've come in with 3% additional stamp duty. They're tapering off the mortgage interest rate relief. In a time when there's a sluggish property market, yields are hard to come by and landlords are selling up, and you can't blame them. So this is leaving us short of housing. And we need all types of housing, rental and owner-occupier. And we need all sorts of rental housing. We need the purpose-built, we need the individual buy-to-let landlords, and we need social housing. We need the caps lifted on the lending so that councils can build as well. We need everyone to chip in with more housing. So it's strange that they've come in now with this idea, oh, and we'll whop on longer tenancies as well. You know, they should be encouraging, not discouraging.
Indeed, and I think this is a concern that, you know, many landlords will want, well, maybe not many, but some landlords will want to throw in the towel, and this could be the last straw. Difficult to know, really, what people's intentions are. Of course, one of the arguments that's made is that the UK is one of the few countries in the EU that has a very short security of tenure. And, you know, this is really just bringing us into line with other EU countries. What do you say to that argument, Chris?
Oh, I get so, so tired of hearing international comparisons. I mean, yes, the way that we structure our framework for housing, for private rented housing particularly, is very different from a lot of other countries. So is every aspect of their economy, their political landscape, their community, and the way that they treat housing, whether that be as an asset or not. I think one of the issues that comes up time and time again in the UK is the way that we treat property or homes as an asset rather than simply that, rather than a home for a household to live in. You know, we are structured very differently, therefore the laws are going to be very different. I would far rather that the UK government actually does its homework on the sector in this country, works out what the needs are rather than knee-jerking to, you know, some sound bites here or a pressure group there. Work out what we need for that collective housing piece, because we do need more social housing, we do need more owner-occupied housing, and we need a lot more private rented housing as well. And perhaps we need to stop talking about private renting housing and social housing as there being some great divide between them. You know, renting is now the dominant tenure, quite frankly. And so I'd like them to look at what we need and stop really looking at what Germany or Sweden or France does and trying to slap it on top of a system that already exists.
Now, if this new model comes in, Chris, I mean, when are we looking at it being implemented? Could it be a couple of years?
How long's a piece of string? I mean, I would be quite surprised, based on this document, whether we are actually looking at a new piece of legislation. I think they're looking at trying to use some levers to encourage people to use a new model tenancy, and that model would default to 3 years. The model currently defaults to 2 years, and I don't think I've ever encountered a landlord that uses it. What they really need to do is invest in some behavioural change, to invest in, you know, pushing organisations like the NLA to educate landlords better, to understand what they do have the flexibility to do, but also to work with schools, to work with other community organisations, to make sure tenants understand what they can ask for. You know, we do quite a lot of research with landlords, but also with tenants. And I was quite surprised to see how high the figure was in the shelter statistics, to say what proportion of households wanted longer tenancies. Because we run this question in a reasonably large survey and a completely free-found survey. It's nothing to do with our members every year. And it's almost exactly 50-50 split between those households who want the shorter tenancy they have and those who want something longer. And we interrogate that. We ask why. You know, some of them simply don't know they can ask for more, and that's something that needs to be corrected. Others say, actually, my job's not very secure, or I'm studying here, or my kids are only in school until X, and they don't want something longer. So there's an education piece on both sides. To go back to your question, though, if they were to legislate for this, bearing in mind everything they've got to do surrounding Europe at the moment, and everything they've already committed to with letting agents and the like, we're probably looking at 2020.
And what about some of the other proposals that are made? For example, possible tax incentives for landlords who offer longer tenancies. And that seems to me to be very complicated because, you know, say, for example, I've got 13 properties, so maybe one or two of them would be on longer tenancies, but some wouldn't. And then, you know, how would I report that to HMRC and how would that be verified, etc.?
With great difficulty. I think it's a simple answer. I've had these conversations with the Treasury and the Ministry now to try and work out what they have in mind. I think the short answer is they don't really know. The only way that we could foresee this happening is some kind of blanket allowance, something akin to the 10% that we used to have for wear and tear. But politically, the idea that this government would give essentially a tax break to private landlords, I just can't see happening. We actually held some focus groups for the Cabinet Office who are developing this policy, working with NLA members to see, you know, how some of these things would work. And the really concerning thing was, this was one of the raft proposals. This was, you know, would you offer a longer tenancy if we gave you a tax incentive? And the examples they came with were pitiful. They didn't recognise the risk that a longer tenancy represented at all. They were a token figure of £100 here, £150 there against your tax bill. And if you're asking somebody to take on a three-year tenancy with an unknown tenant, you could be looking at thousands of pounds worth of risk that it's not going to mitigate.
Carol, do you think it would be reasonable for landlords to only be able to evict tenants using, it's called the Section 8 procedure, which is where you have to have a reason and it has to go before a court judge and, you know, the tenant is effectively allowed to stay in the property for 3 years unless you can get that court order. So, you know, the landlord's kind of losing a lot of their flexibility. I mean, do you think that's what society, housing needs? Do you think it's reasonable?
I think it's reasonable to have a reason. I think it's reasonable to have a reason to evict someone. Yes, I mean, I don't know if that's how it works legally, but presumably you want to evict them because they're messing up the place or they're not paying their rent. I mean, you can't just come along one day and say, I want you out. Presumably landlords don't do that now. So I don't think that is unreasonable. I think it's more a question of how the flexibility is built in to give landlords the ability to get back their properties when they need to, and for tenants to have the security they need. I think it's a balancing act between the two halves.
One of the arguments that landlords make is that the court process just takes too long. On average, it's 22 weeks, according to the consultation document in the private rented sector. And, you know, that's 6 months in which the tenant might not be paying rent and they might be abusing the property because they're angry with the landlord, etc. So a lot of landlords say until the court service is reformed, this is unworkable.
I'd agree. I think the court service being reformed should be a priority. But I don't think the answer is allowing people to evict people without reason.
And, I mean, the government's after a more stable private rented sector. Do you see longer tenancies creating kind of more stable society?
I do, but I question whether the government really does want a more stable. It's not, the things it's doing do not add up to a more stable rental sector, which was the point I was trying to make before. And I think somewhere in the back of someone's mind is, we can almost do anything because it'll be better than the prospect of Corbyn with his rent caps and his higher taxation. So we could, you know, things like this consultation, it's almost like a trial balloon to see what we can get away with. You know, how angry will they get?
Chris, you will presumably be pleased to see that the consultation document is not keen on rent control and it's quite liberal on that idea. And, you know, the risk is hugely increased for landlords, as you've mentioned, and yet there aren't any proposals for improving the court situation.
There aren't. It pays some lip service to having to conduct a review. And I think that the crux of the issue for me is not actually what they're proposing. It's the sequencing of what they want to do. And if you want to get to a situation where you give landlords and tenants confidence, so tenants' confidence that it's their home and they can stay there unless they do something wrong, and landlords' confidence that if something does go wrong, they're not going to go bankrupt, you're not going to get to these outcomes. I think what the government are doing are picking off symptoms. You know, there's an affordability issue, there's an access to property issue, so we look at fees. You're not looking at what is ultimately the biggest problem, there's no supply. But if you're going to encourage private supply, you've got to encourage that confidence. Now, if they'd have announced a complete review of the court service, run that through, seen some positive outcomes from that, and then said, well, now we've given you what you've been asking for years, a Section 8 process, a fault process that works, well, we're going to look at that Section 21 that, with the best will in the world, you've overused a bit for the last 20 years. Now, the NLA, we defend that to the hilt, but we can recognise we use that because we've got no confidence in the other system. What they're doing now is trying to change the bit that we use and really value and say, in the future, we're going to look at the other bit. And I can tell you now, I sat down with a consultant that the Ministry have hired to look at the court service and to look at all of the problems. And, you know, he's really receptive. He understood what we were saying. But I don't think I'm breaching any confidences here. When I asked him how bought in are the Ministry of Justice, who are the department responsible for the courts, he couldn't really give me an answer. You know, I don't have a great deal of confidence that when we get to the end of this, we'll actually see improvements in the courts. We'll just see another little bit of confidence chipped away from the landlord market.
Okay, well, the consultation continues until the 26th of August. And if you're a landlord or indeed a tenant and you're interested in contributing to the consultation, then do go online and search for it. It's called Overcoming Barriers to Longer Tenancies in the Private Rented Sector. Well, moving on, there's a new training initiative launched by Student Minds and the property portal students.com to try and help landlords cope better with student tenants who have mental health issues. They're launching an online webinar, and there's also going to be offline training at the student.com's offices. Now, I was looking at stats earlier today, and student suicide rates have increased by 56% between 2006 and 2017, according to some research. There were 146 suicides in 2016, which is the highest on record, and there's been a fivefold increase in the number of students reporting mental health issues. Carol, you'll be aware that there are lots of kind of new build student blocks, aren't there? Often run by private companies. How well do you think they're placed to try and cope with students with mental health issues?
Probably better place than individual landlords. I think the big blocks could work with councils and have councillors in-house maybe, or visiting in-house. But I think ultimately it's not the landlord's job to try and be a specialist in mental health. There are specialists who do that, and they do that very well. What we need to do is try and see how they might work with the big purpose-built blocks. But individual landlords, I don't think they should have that onerous task put on them to have a social care role.
What do you think, Chris? Because, you know, I often talk about landlords needing to have a kind of inner community worker. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I quite like sort of face-to-face contact with tenants. I come from a community work background, so maybe that's just me. I know I have some colleagues in the landlord community who have a similar approach. And, of course, increasingly landlords are having to house more vulnerable tenants, perhaps nominated by local authorities, etc. So are these skills that landlords should be developing?
I think we've all got a duty of care. You know, the private rented sector is much bigger than it was previously. It's much more diverse. And therefore, I suppose our contact points with a whole plethora of people have increased. So being able to identify risk factors, you know, spotting someone who's unduly anxious, spotting someone who, you know, whose lifestyle has become more chaotic. In my previous life as a letting agent, we had a number of individual tenants that we knew we had a bit of a watching brief for, because relatives had contacted us and had said, actually, I know you go around there every 12 weeks, but when you're in the area, could you knock on the door and tell us if they're still there? And we would do that from time to time. But I think it would be unreasonable to try and put some kind of responsibility onto an individual landlord, because as well as having that duty of care and that moral obligation to spot something, we've also got to make sure they have quiet enjoyment of their home. You know, it's not a landlord's job to turn up every other week and ask how you're doing. That could very, very easily be classed as harassment rather than a social good.
It's true. Actually, Carol, sometimes I hear student landlords saying that they feel they're sort of in loco parentis with younger students, and they feel like they're, you know, a kind of friendly aunt or uncle, and that they need to kind of look after them a bit. Do you think that's too interfering, or what do you think?
It makes me cringe a bit, yeah. I mean, when I was a student, I never saw the landlord, you know, at times I wanted him to come round. But yeah, I don't think they should feel they should take that role on. I mean, if they want to and they have that relationship with the tenants, then that's a different thing. But I don't think there should be any onus on them to be responsible for their tenants in terms of mental health. It's a specialist job to pick up some of the subtle signs between someone who's anxious about exams and someone's about to commit suicide. That's not something that should be resting with a landlord.
Yes, I guess there's a danger they could cause more problems than help, actually, if they don't have the appropriate skills.
I think so.
Well, if you have any thoughts on this or any other topics we're discussing today, do let us know via the website insideproperty.org.uk. You're listening to Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco, and my guests, Carol Lewis from The Times and Chris Norris from the National Landlords Association. Well, moving on to our next topic, August is one of the months when the Bank of England issues its quarterly inflation report. Now, a number of economists were predicting a potential rate rise in August. In fact, the chief economist, Andy Haldane, and two other members of the Monetary Policy Committee were pushing for a rate rise, it was said. But we've just heard that the latest inflation figures remain at 2.4%, and that's therefore shed doubt on whether or not there will be a rate rise. The bank base rate was cut to 0.5% in March 2009 and has been, you know, at that rate, and it was also slightly lower for some time. So it's nearly 10 years now that we've had such low rates. How are you feeling about this now, Carol? Do you think we're likely to get a rate rise in August?
No, I'd say not. The expected inflation was 2.6. It came in at 2.4. We've got quite soft data on wage growth, i.e. it hasn't grown at all. Currency has taken a bit of battering over the political situation. So I think it's not as likely as we thought. Everyone was kind of money on the table for August. And also last time the vote was 7-2 to hold. That's quite a shift now, given the data. I mean, Carney's sick and tired of being called the unreliable boyfriend, so he kind of wants to get it over, but I think August might be too soon. If I was betting, I might go for Super Thursday on November. Super Thursday is when they bring out an inflation report and the MPC reports. November 1st is the next one of those. There's another meeting in between in September, but I think they might wait to November. And I think even then, they'll probably only go up by 0.25 percentage points. I think we're looking at 0.75 maybe by the end of the year. I think it's going to be really slow, maybe up to 1% 2019-2020. I don't think, unless they misjudge it and leave it too late and then have to go up quick, I don't think we're going to see a spike. I think it is going to be gradual.
One of the frustrations I find with this, Carol, is that the Mark Carney seems to have been hinting at rate rises for goodness knows how many years. I've been, you know, on the verge of switching some of my trackers to fixed rates and then pulled back from it. I did that in May and I'm about to pull back again from doing it now. It almost seems like just hinting at the possibility that the bank might do that is enough. They don't end up actually having to raise rates.
Yes, and it's been priced in by the markets for a long time now. So, I mean, it has had an effect, him hinting, definitely.
Right. Now, Chris, I know you're not very keen at predicting interest rate rises. Do you want to comment?
You're right. I'm really not very keen at doing this because I've been wrong so many times in the past. But I couldn't disagree with anything that's already been said. We keep thinking it's coming. I keep saying things like rates can only go in one direction. And then I'm proved wrong. So all we can really do is wait and see. But I would agree, whatever happens, there's really no need for landlords to panic right now because we're looking at at a 3-year process probably to get back to anywhere that looks like what I would call normality.
There is this issue that we've had interest rates at such low rates for so long, so we've almost got a generation of landlords that don't know any different, and that worries the Bank of England, doesn't it? Does it worry you, Chris?
It worries me a lot. It really does. One of the questions we ask our members when we do our research is at what point they would start to get uncomfortable, I suppose, with interest rates, because they've had it their own way for quite a long time. And yet the answers we get back, they haven't really changed a lot. You know, people start to feel a squeeze at about 3.5%. But when we're looking at the businesses and the yields that are underpinning that, they really have changed over the last decade. And when we do more qualitative work and we ask landlords what they look for, and when I started at the NLA pre-credit crunch, I remember talking to our former vice chairman about this and explaining the process he went through when he bought a property. And he said, well, if I can't yield 9%, I'm not looking at it. Which was perfectly normal for 2006-07. Any landlord today who thought they might get 9% because they were trying to cover a 7% mortgage, you know, would have a slightly odd business, should we say. But there's a lot of people, I think, that will be shocked when we get to 1.5-2%, if we get to 1.5-2% in those mortgages. But in reality, if you took out a mortgage at a 0.5% base rate 10 years ago, you're halfway through that term.
Yes, it's true. And in fact, talking of mortgages, buy-to-let lending is down by 22%, and first-time buyer mortgages are up by 8%. So it would seem that government policy to restrict landlords and encourage home ownership is working. What do you think, Carol?
Well, I think the value of mortgages has gone down. So you've got a lot of competition between the lenders now. They're scrabbling for fewer people to try and pull them in because the government's policies have made it less desirable to be a landlord. But the result of the competition is that we've got the lowest rates on buy-to-let mortgages on both 2- and 5-year fixes than we had for 2 years at least.
Yes, 1.99%, I think, from the Mortgage Works at the moment, at 50% loan to value. That's the lowest 5-year fix for buy-to-let I've ever seen.
There's some incredible deals out there because they're all scrabbling for a smaller pool of buy-to-let borrowers. But the worry is, as you were saying, that people will come out of the fixes at quite high relative interest rates. Although, having said that, to balance that, the lending criteria has been stricter on potential landlords. So yes, I mean, I think it's worrying, but it's not diabolical.
Some lenders shied away from lending to portfolio landlords,
yes.
Carol. That's landlords who have 4 or more properties.
I think they'll change their minds. I think portfolio lending is up. I think the figures this week were 18% are in portfolios. That's of rental properties, but with landlords. So I think, you know, they're businesses. Banks are businesses. They will go where the business is. If the business isn't in the smaller buy-to-let lenders, they'll switch to the portfolio.
Yes, I mean, we've seen Virgin Money, for example. I was a Virgin Money customer, and they decided to stop lending to portfolio landlords when the new criteria came in last October. But lo and behold, this year, they are now going to be lending to portfolio landlords, and that seems to me to be driven by what's going on in the business.
Yeah, they have to get the customers where they can.
I mean, are we seeing signs here, Chris, of fewer landlords buying? I mean, I've been looking at stats. Apparently in Scotland, there's been an increase in sales by landlords of 18%, potentially driven by the changes in tenancies there. Now tenancies are lifelong, potentially. It's quite hard to get data that shows that, you know, there's this vast sell-up happening by landlords. But we seem to be getting sort of anecdotal bits of information that suggest some changes in behaviour, don't we?
Yeah, there's pockets of data. And, you know, the NLA is one of those, although we're a self-selecting membership, so we can't pretend that we're representative of the entire market. Scotland is very interesting because there's been so much political change. And as you mentioned, you've had a 30-year-old default tenancy replaced by something brand new. We're seeing the first cases go to tribunal now, but not only is the process changed, the institution's changed. You no longer go to the courts, you go to the tribunal. There's so much uncertainty that I wouldn't blame any landlord in Scotland selling up at this point, or certainly not investing more, but time will tell. In England, it's intriguing. I mean, I hope there is a shift back towards portfolio lending, because the anecdotal data that we get from our members calling for advice is they're really struggling. And what we're seeing from some of the lenders that we work with is a real scramble for new landlords, you know, new blood into the marketplace. And on one hand, that's great, get more people in, get more investment. On the other hand, I'm sceptical, perhaps, if the people who've been in the market for a while and have been, you know, trained and educated and understand what they're doing are saying now's not a great time to invest. I wonder how it works out for the new entrants and what will happen in a few years' time. You know, we saw a mad rush before the SDLT change came in the levy, and whilst it's incredibly difficult to tell cause, we see correlation in people selling 3 years down the line, possibly when we get to the end of these fixed terms. I wonder what we'll see in another 3 years when some of these people get to the end of their fixes, perhaps see what's happening with interest rates and perhaps see what's happened with the changes to interest rate relief, which they may not have known about in its entirety when they got into the market.
Yes, and of course those tax bills are going to be landing on mats this year, aren't they? And I've just done worked out my taxes and have seen for the first time that bit on which I don't get relief, and it hurts. Really makes you think. What's your feeling of what's going on, Carol? Do you think people are less likely to go into buy-to-let now? Because we used to say we had about 100,000 a year new entrants into the market.
The Hamptons International data on England and Wales shows, yes, there are landlords selling up and there are more selling than new ones buying. Mm. But the shortfall at the moment is a couple of thousand. So we're losing, 2,000 buy-to-let houses or accommodation a year, which is significant, but it's not massive. What we can't tell is, those that are buying, are they new or are they people who went out and have come back in? I mean, yes, I think it's possibly worrying because we need those properties in the market. We need rental properties there. My worry is, as you were saying, that actually it's going to get worse in the next couple of years as people come off their mortgage deals, as they actually realise what it means to their pocket when they see their tax bills. I don't know if the 3-year tenancies came in, whether that would make a difference. So on the one side, the banks would be worried that they can't repossess quickly. But on the other side, if you've got good payers in for 3 years guaranteed, then maybe there's some stability there. I'm not sure how the banks would respond to that.
OK, well, moving on, it's all change at the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government. We're on to our third Housing Minister of the year, Kit Malthouse. Carol, do you have much faith in the government's housing policy, given that, you know, we've got a bit of a revolving door in this particular ministry?
And I have no confidence that Kit will be here for a long time either. I have no confidence at the moment the government will be here for a long time. But I think he was a slightly surprising choice. If I was to have to choose a Tory colleague to lead the housing policy agenda, which they say is one of their top priorities, this is what they say, there were more qualified people out there. Kevin Hollenrake, he's an estate agency founder. He's a member of the Housing Communities and Local Government Committee. He's got a bit of background. Mark Prisk, former housing minister and a former surveyor. So, you know, there are people out there who actually have experience, and we know that they're committed to this priority. Malthouse has, as far as I know, not done much in this field. In fact, he was pretty derogatory about homeless people when he was at the London Assembly with Boris Johnson. So it doesn't bode well. But anyway, let's give him time. Let's see what he's got.
There's been some. I'll come to you in a minute, Chris. Yeah. There's been some controversy, Carol, in the press as well, because he's not given up his job as director of a loans company.
I know, and that to me is him saying this isn't worth my full attention.
Right. Responses, Chris.
I try not to read much into second jobs, particularly when it is the housing minister and you don't know how long they're going to be there. I'm starting to think, actually, when we do these recordings, we should do a bit of radio magic. We should pause for a beat before the housing minister's name, just so we can chop and change for the next one. Because I have got no confidence that Kit Malthouse will be here in 6 months. And that's no reflection on the man. I don't know what his views on housing will be. As it happens, because his immediate previous job was at the Department for Work and Pensions, I'd sat down with him about a week before he got this job to talk about Universal Credit. and was hopeful that he was just getting his feet under the table there and we might see some kind of movement. He's obviously been moved again, and we shall wait and see. I'm a little bit more enthusiastic about the new Secretary of State. I think James Brokenshire is a good appointment there. He's one of the ministers that the NLA and I personally have spent more time working with than most, because he was the immigration minister when Right to Rent was brought in. And Right to Rent was, you know, very controversial and very complicated, and he gave an awful lot of time to that, which is not that common for a minister. So I was quite pleased to see him, A, coming back into government after a health scare, but B, getting this job, which, you know, is important right now.
I was surprised to see his introduction to the consultation document, because it seemed quite pro the sort of shelter housing charity line. Should I not read anything into that? Is that just what the civil servant's written? Or
I wouldn't read too much of the minister's opinion into it personally, but you certainly can read a lot of what the department are thinking into that. And the department has also had an awful lot of churn. You know, with the high profile changes are at the ministerial level, but you know, civil servants get churned around a lot, and certainly with all of the focus on, you know, quite rightly, on Grenfell and on Safely, a lot of talent has been shifted into other areas, and you know, there's been a need to fill positions. Now, I'm certainly not trying to knock the civil servants who are doing the job at the moment, but a lot of them are very new, and they will lean on people who look like they're giving them support, and you know, some of that may well be coming from the likes of Shelter and other groups.
Mm. Now, Carol, your newspaper has reported, it's a YouGov poll, that the Labour Party has a 5-point lead. This is after the Chequers white paper outlining Theresa May's plans for Brexit. The Tory party is just about held together by their fear of the prospect of Jeremy Corbyn becoming Prime Minister, I think, at the moment. And of course, landlords have quite a lot to fear potentially from Jeremy Corbyn becoming Prime Minister. He said that he wants to bring in rent caps, that he's not in favour of no-fault evictions. What do you think of the prospects for housing under Jeremy Corbyn as PM?
I have to say, I'm surprised it's as low as 5%, given the mess that we're in over the Brexit agreement and the shambles that we see every day in the Houses of Parliament. 5% doesn't seem that impressive, does it, really?
No,
it really doesn't. Mm. You'd expect him to be right up there at the moment. This is his moment. So, yes, maybe they are being held together by a fear of Corbyn. I don't think it's that orchestrated, to be honest. What is bizarre is one of the last votes, I think yesterday, actually Theresa May only won because three of the Labour bench voted for her. So are they afraid of Corbyn as PM?
Probably, yeah.
Possibly.
I mean, Jeremy Corbyn's record is long, isn't it, Chris, in terms of what he wants to do housing-wise, the abolition of Section 21, etc. And, you know, it looks like it could really be a game-changer, really, for me in terms of my business as a landlord. Maybe it would, you know, really answer a lot of the things that shelter and housing charities are looking for.
It's incredibly difficult to predict what would happen. And we do know, for want of anything else, that quite aside from the rest of his cabinet and the rest of his manifesto, an opposition to private renting, shall we say, is something that he's personally held for a very, very long time. You know, the NLA had reason to meet with Jeremy Corbyn every year as a backbencher, because he introduced the same private members bill every year, all about the private rented sector. And it was the things you've already mentioned. It was rent controls, it was security of tenure. It was very similar to the 1970s model of regulation. So there's an awful lot to fear there. Whether he would do any better at keeping a Labour cabinet together right now in comparison with May, I don't know.
I don't think so.
The one positive, and I would...
I don't think so.
The one positive, and I do... You know, my members wouldn't thank me for finding positives about Corbyn, probably, is that the man heading up housing for Labour actually does know quite a lot about housing. I don't necessarily agree with him on all of the positions, but John Healey was housing minister in the last Labour government, he did some things we liked, he did some things we didn't like, and he managed not to do a lot more that we probably wouldn't have liked. But he has got a grounding in housing, so at least there's some understanding on that side of the benches, I suppose, and somebody who could be our first repeat housing minister if there's an election. I wouldn't welcome it, but we could see it.
Also, the landscape is very different now for Corbyn, were he to win. I mean, if his policies are stuck in the 1970s, the landscape is very, very different. You know, the council housing has been sold off. Councils are not building. Yep. We've got build to rent in. We've got housing associations. The world is a different place, and he's going to have to adapt to that.
Well, who knows who could be housing minister by the time you listen to this programme. But we've come to the end of the programme. And my thanks to my guests, Chris Norris and Carol Lewis. And of course, to you for listening. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the programme. Maybe you'd like to leave a review on Audioboom or iTunes. And would you be interested in joining a listeners panel? If so, please do get in touch via the website, which is insideproperty.org.uk. Inside Property is produced in collaboration with the National Landlords Association.